Welcome. We're glad you're here to breakout session number four, Navigating Life's Transitions. You got some wonderful things on your seat to look through here as you're listening to the presentation. I just want to let everyone know that this will be recorded. This is not being videotaped or anything, but just audio recorded so that you can listen to it, or people who didn't get a chance to be here in person can listen to the information later. So I'm going to be passing later, when we get a chance for questions, around this box. And it doesn't look like anything but a box, but it's actually a microphone. So when you have a question later on, I may hand it to you, and you can just talk into the front of it here on top. It's pretty neat how that works. And my name is Jackie, so welcome. I'm just going to be giving a little bit of info before we start and introduce our lovely speakers. So I already mentioned that this is going to be recorded. We would like you to hold any questions you have for the end so that we can get through all the wonderful information that they want to share first. But if you have a question you're worried you're going to forget to ask, you can write it down on the pink sheet. These pink sheets can also be turned in at the end of our session. And Sarah can reach out to you and get your question specifically answered if she doesn't have a chance to do it today. And she's also going to stay after to chat with anyone that needs to ask questions. She'll also be at the resource fair, so you'll have chances to connect with her if you don't get your specific question answered today. And she said the same for Rebecca, mm-hmm. who's also speaking, that she'll make sure and connect you to Rebecca if you have questions more specifically related to Rebecca's information. So we're just going to keep everything brief if you do have a question later, and we'll make sure and try our best to get to all those. The nearest restrooms are at the end of the hallway, or you can head downstairs to the restrooms down there if need be too. Okay, so I think we'll get started here. Sarah Briner, the legal mama, as some of you may know her as, is a seasoned estate planning attorney and certified personal family lawyer. As the founder of Briner Law Firm, she leverages her 22 years of experience guiding families to navigate the complexities of estate planning while providing comprehensive life and legacy planning solutions. Sarah empowers families to make informed decisions around protecting their future and assets through legal and financial education. Sarah is dedicated to ensuring that everyone has the security of knowing their wishes are honored and their loved ones are protected. Rebecca Rich is a registered nurse and member of the Minnesota Association for Guardianship and Conservatorship. She owned and operated Minnetonka Assisted Living and Hospice from 2005 to 2012, specializing in general care, geriatric care, diabetic management, and memory care. She's also an educator with 12 years of experience. Rebecca's professional geriatric experience has proven invaluable to communities, families in need of specialized care for their loved ones. She also serves as a consultant to individuals who are struggling with issues of parent care and in need of finding elder care programs or professional caregivers to meet their needs. So you didn't come here to listen to me, so I'm going to hand it over to Sarah and Rebecca now.
Thank you so much, Jackie. I'm a little bit technologically challenged, so I hope that the slideshow will work, and Rebecca and I are going to kind of tag team. Can everybody hear me okay? What we're talking about. So the reason that I do this kind of education and planning is I was a managing partner at a pretty large firm in Atlanta, litigator for a number of years, more than a decade, and so I've seen all the things that go wrong. And so I tackle the education with kind of starting at the end of how things go wrong and then moving backwards of how do we fix those things, and really just giving foundational education about planning, because in my experience, there's so much misinformation out there. We can Dr. Google till our heart's content and find a lot of mismatching or misinformation out there. And what I have found over the years is that the plans that tend to fail, or families that think they have done proper planning, it doesn't tend to work out that way because they either did things online or through a more traditional old school method that isn't really serving clients the way it should. So when I opened my practice, it was really to focus on the ways to do things how they should be done, not just because the bar says we can do it this way and that's good enough. So that's really kind of how I tackle the information. Do you want to talk a little bit about
So I serve as a guardian conservator and a rep payee, so I help people through the rep payee business pay their bills. The guardianship and conservatorship is court-appointed for somebody who has an incapacitation where the court has determined that they need more help from an individual. Could be finding housing. It could be medical decision-making. It could be managing assets. It could, you know, there's just a large variety, and I'll get into that a little bit more later.
And people come to you in a number of different ways, right? Because, like, I know with our planning, I have a lot of clients that will come to me and say, I don't have anyone I feel comfortable putting in a position of my healthcare agent or managing my money. I don't have someone responsible or that will honor my wishes or any of those things. I reach out to Rebecca and say, hey, I have a family that needs someone to act as a professional in that capacity because they don't have someone they wish or trust to do that.
And we're also named in estate plans, so when the time comes, if somebody needs an executor, we serve in that capacity as well. Or if somebody wants to appoint us as a power of attorney or healthcare agent, we can do that. We can sit in the background until our services are needed. If somebody is younger and wants to make sure that their estate plan names a guardian for their minor children, we can be named in that capacity. So a lot of complementary roles between the two of us.
Yeah. So that's me. So first I'm going to talk a little bit about the essential estate planning tools, what things are, and then Rebecca's going to kind of jump in as she serves in those roles of kind of some of the things that we're talking about. So what we're going to focus on today with the legal tools are the main key things that go in every what we call estate plan. That would be wills, trust, healthcare directives, and power of attorney. And I will tell you, I'm going to kind of blast through these things. I can geek out on this for hours, and I could talk on every little bullet point for probably 2 hours. So what I want you guys to be able to accomplish in being here is getting the base information to be able to master what legal documents you need to protect your assets strategically, not just by saying this person gets this and that's the end of it. And then Rebecca is going to talk about leveraging support systems to execute those plans and navigating the benefits and resources. I put everything in the legal document of what you want to happen, and then actually making that happen, we have to have those trusted advisors, support systems, and things in place. And then hopefully the two of us, if we accomplish our job, will help you build confidence in planning and kind of knowing what your next steps should be and how to go about doing that. There's Rebecca's information. So anything you want to add there?
No.
Awesome. That's fine. And if anybody would like a copy of, I didn't print it out because it's just a lot, but if anybody would like a digital copy of the presentation afterwards, you can either turn in your pink worksheet or take the contact information and email me, and I'm happy to share this with anyone. All right, so like I said, starting at the end of how estate plans fail, the main thing is they're not kept up to date, or the family is not communicating about their wishes with their family members. A lot of times we feel we want to keep those things private. We don't want to cause family drama or dynamics of saying we made this choice or put this person in charge. And very specifically, we're seeing more and more as the baby boomer generation gets older that there isn't multi-generational coordination, or assets are not documented or owned properly. We don't know where things are, how to find them, or what exists. So the things that we do to fix that is, one, if you have a plan in place, you should be reviewing that every 1 to 3 years, depending on what you're dealing with in your family. If you are a caregiver or helping someone manage their care and their both legal, financial, or healthcare needs, depending on how rapidly that is changing, that may look like updating and checking in on the legal side or financial or advisory side every year instead of 3 years. It is okay to talk about money. And I want, you know, this is also very generational, and I always try to encourage everyone. I don't care whether you're 80 or 20. This is not your grandmother's estate planning anymore. We talk about money. It's okay to share. You don't have to say what you have, but that you have a plan for it and those kind of things. It's important to include both your parents and your children in your planning and letting them know what you've done for them and how you're helping, whether it's what you're leaving to your kids or putting in place for an adult dependent, but having them included in that conversation and knowing what the plan is in the flow is incredibly helpful in making sure everybody, yeah, do you want?
Well, I was just going to say, there are sometimes family dynamics where you don't want to share that information too,
also
and
true.
That's okay.
That is also okay.
It's okay, and you don't necessarily, you know, like Sarah said, sometimes it just creates extra drama where drama is not needed. And you're not like committed to leave things to your children or your parents or whoever it is. You can leave it to, organizations that you really like. And Sarah will talk about this in a minute, but one reason why it's important to plan is you want to make those wishes known ahead of time. That way, when the time comes, people who may disagree with you or what your choices are won't have a say in the matter because your wishes will be honored.
And you are not required to tell anyone. You've put them in a role of authority as an agent or an actor of any kind. They don't have to sign off on anything when you do your planning. They don't have to know in advance. The key to that is if you say, I don't want our kids or, you know, family members to know that I chose this person over this person or that's going to cause tension or drama. Nobody needs to know any of that. The key is that you have documented and put a plan in place that not only says, I have a health care directive, I have a will, I have a trust, but how are you guiding them to know what to do when they find out they are in that role? But nobody has to agree or sign off ahead of time. Okay, so what is estate planning? When we talk about estate planning, I talk about or think about estate planning as a very old way of going about documenting what you want upon your death or incapacity. So we use wills, we use trusts, we use healthcare directives, and we use powers of attorney to document those things. Anything you want to add on that?
Nope, not yet.
Okay. The reason why that is an outdated system is because when we talk about estate planning, that is transactional. That is someone or yourself preparing documents and hoping that it's right and it's going to apply however many years down the road and things like that. Most traditional law firms and, you know, things like LegalZoom, online, those kind of things have a lot of confusion and issues around them. Mainly things of who will know what to do, how to find the things, know what the even next step is when they lose someone and they want to know, okay, I know I'm in charge as an executor or an agent or a trustee, but like, what does that mean? How do I actually do that thing? Will your family know how to find the assets? Okay, great. We have accounts. Maybe we have life insurance. Maybe we have retirement accounts. A long time ago, when we had paper mail as the main form of communication, when someone passed, we would have all their mail forwarded to the executor. Now everything's digital. We don't know to request that, how to access it, how to log into anything. And if you are leaving your loved ones with a plan, is it confusing? Does it tell them what to do, right? So how do they get the guidance once you're gone to execute what you've documented you want to happen? What are you leaving them with financially? Are you leaving them with minimal assets, which is okay. It's great to pass money on to people, but that's not truly our legacy. Our legacy is the other things, the human value that we want to pass on, our values, our insights, our stories, our histories, you know, the things that we're trying to create and pass on in the world. What kind of children are we raising? What kind of humans are we putting into the world? Those things aren't documented in your will and trust. If you have minor children or dependents that you're responsible for at any age, how do you have a plan set up outside of those traditional documents that say what would happen if, there's an accident or an emergency situation and we don't have anything to document who or what can step in that interim? And
I believe you can also record some of these documents with the county as well.
Yes, if you choose. You're not required in Minnesota.
Right, but that's just one way that people can, it's a resource where people can go to look up and see if you have a will, especially if original can't be found. Those are certified with the county that you live in.
Yeah, absolutely. Most people don't do it because it's not required here. So I can tell you in like the bar listservs and things, we have like estate planning ones where people post every day. Did anyone ever at their firm or individually represent so-and-so? We're trying to find a will and nobody knows if there is one every day. So having someone know how to access original documents, they should be in a safe, those kind of things is really, really crucial. Okay. are we maybe not connected anymore? I don't know what's happening. Okay. Just forward.
You can do it from your computer.
Yeah. Are we stuck? Yay. Okay. So the kind of estate planning that I do and that I encourage most people to seek out is what I refer to as life and legacy planning instead of estate planning. So when we talk about estate planning, we're talking about planning for death or incapacity. That's it. Nothing is triggered until that time. When we talk about life and legacy planning, we're including life in there. So we're talking about a plan for both life, incapacity, and death. How do you make sure that if there's an emergency or something unexpected that you're not planning for, that you have the right things in place? So we look at things like making sure that legal and financial clarity is there, that decisions, not only are you making guided decisions properly, but that somebody knows how to follow those, and then having trusted advisors, not just going to someone that's going to be transactional, turn over documents to you and say, you know, have a nice life, make sure you get your stuff in your trust, and, you know, let us know if you need something. Well, by the time you realize you need something, the docs are usually outdated or you're missing something. And then when we talk about trusted advisor services,
that's where my services come in, where our company is usually mentioned in an estate plan. For example, my company is called Guardian and Conservator Services. It says exactly what we do. But we also serve as a trustee. We also serve in the role of rep payee, representative payee through the Social Security Administration, where through our second company called Payee Partners, it's a nonprofit, and Social Security has authorized us to go ahead and assist people with paying bills with their Social Security money if they need that assistance, if that's deemed.
When is a rep payee triggered, or like when we find out we need one?
So a rep payee can happen at multiple ages. For example, we have clients that are in their late teens, early 20s due to maybe a disability. And so that money will come into our office and we will pay their rent and we will pay their utility bills. We'll pay their phone bills. We'll give them their spending money every single month. The guardianship piece is court appointed. So you have to have some sort of incapacitation, and it's quite the legal process. Well, I shouldn't say quite. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. You need to present some information to the court, and there's some court hearings that have to happen, and everybody that's an interested party gets to know what's going on. And then the court will appoint our company to step in that role as well. And I'll get into some of those tasks that we do a little bit later. But, yeah.
Awesome.
Also, if you need services such as a rep payee, you can also call the Social Security Administration, and you can also apply online. And they will appoint somebody within your geographical area that you live in to get you the help that you need. And on the back of, there's one here, on the back of this pamphlet, I list, I know it's kind of hard to read, but that's the printer's fault, and it lists all sorts of resources that you can engage. These are all free resources to assist you in your journey for what services you need.
Lots of guidance. Okay. So when we talk about that life and legacy planning, or moving away from the old model of planning, I am what we call a personal family lawyer. You'll see there's a registered trademark there. Think of it kind of like a certified financial planner, where they go through additional training to specialize in their field and have a more like higher fiduciary responsibility, things like that. So, personal family lawyers, we are a network nationally and in Canada, and we go through additional certification training, and we maintain membership in a network that allows us to provide services on a higher level and at more breadth than you would with that more transactional experience. And so what we do is we spend a lot of time guiding and coaching to help make decisions, not just document them. So we really want to be that personal family lawyer, you know, for your lifetime and be able to be there to support your family members or, you know, who you're responsible for, who you're leaving things to when you cannot be in that role any longer. We go above just the documents and do things like put ID cards in your wallet. So if there's an accident, you have reference, like if you have minor kids or you are responsible for an adult dependent, if something happens to you, someone needs to know they're at home waiting for you to get back there to help them. And maybe it's just that you have fur babies at home. It's any level of that. So we do things like putting ID cards in your wallet now that we can't get smartphones open and those kind of things. And if it's things like minor children, we certainly don't want them being picked up by Child Protective Services till someone, you know, first responders can figure things out. And, you know, there's so many, obviously, that are parallel to that when we have someone with memory care issues or dependency where they really can't be left on their own for very long. And I think you guys cover some of that too, right?
Yep. And you can also list on your driver's license that you have a living will.
Some people choose not to do those things like organ donation because they feel nervous about putting it on their driver's license, but we document all of that through things like that as well. We also really focus very specifically on making sure that if you have anyone that you don't trust to make decisions or you don't want them, if they're the last person standing, to be the default person, if they're a dangerous actor or someone you don't trust or don't align with for whatever reason, that is not part of the traditional planning either, and we have a way to legally document that. So really, we're here to make sure that your planning is actually getting done. It is staying updated. We have programs that include all of our plans are flat fee and include a 3-year review. So when you're looking for attorneys that are doing this work, obviously you want to find someone that aligns with your, you know, style and dynamic and your needs and communicates with you the way you need. But my recommendation is always to make sure that you're looking for someone who does flat fee planning, that you're not getting surprised with how long it ended up taking or that something got in the way, or you don't want to ask questions when you actually need to get that follow-up support because you're at the bank and you have a 5-minute question and you're like, well, I'm going to get a $150 bill in the mail, so forget it, and then it doesn't get done. So all of that communication and ongoing support is built into planning when you're picking that right lawyer so that you're able to feel comfortable asking questions whenever something comes up, even if it's 10 years from now, because you did planning and luckily you haven't needed it for a while.
And just to add, you mentioned banking. You can also bring your trust to the bank and they will keep a copy of it for you. Especially if you have a trust banking account or a savings account or CDs or other investments, I recommend sharing all of your legal documents with those entities so they can have it on file.
Absolutely. And most of them will require it when we're talking about things like creating trust and trust funding. So going back to some of the basics about planning in general, every adult needs basic estate planning to keep out of court and conflict. Pure and simple. If you have a child or a dependent who is over 18, they need their own individual documents. Even if they are your dependent, you don't get to automatically make decisions for them anymore, both healthcare or financially. You have to have that documented. If they are not able to document those things on their own, that's when we have guardian and other conservator services that come in and assist with that process.
Yeah, we see a lot of court cases where maybe a disabled teenager turns 18, now they're an adult, and they still need a decision maker for themselves. So sometimes families will, or parents will still want to maintain that responsibility, and sometimes families just want to be family, and they would like a professional appointed to help, or another family member, just somebody else to step in that role and help make decisions and other choices that we'll get into in a little bit for that individual.
You know, it used to be we would really only see certain age groups come in and doing planning, and now it's very broad across the board. There are key reasons why someone with minor children needs to do planning for that kind of guardianship, and obviously, they're, you know, all the way up to taking care of your parents. If you're anywhere in the, like, Gen X over 40, 30s to 40s age, we are what we call the sandwich generation, if you've ever heard that before. We are sandwiched between taking care of our children and taking care of our elderly parents, and we're trying to do it all, and that's very noble. Don't be a hero. We can't do it all. And so when we're talking about going back to the funding and the middle comment, which is that it is a very common myth that if you have created a will whether you filed it with the court or not, that that is going to keep you out of the probate or court system. That is false. If you have a will, you are going through court if you do not also have a trust to go along with that. So really what it comes down to is budget. If wills are the only things you're creating, the only reason that should be happening is because that is what your budget allows. If you can afford to do more planning in advance, you are looking at it is an expensive process, and there's lots of information. Feel free to ask questions about what that looks like. But generally speaking, you're looking at a couple $1,000s more to do trust planning than will planning. However, changing that around will save you roughly 2% of the value of your entire estate when it comes time to administer it and avoiding court and conflict. So when we talk about properly funding a revocable trust, I'll talk about that a little more. We probably won't have time to go into much of that. So if anyone has questions about like the in and outs of what that really means, please ask me.
Well, just one quick thing before she goes on here is when you are talking about revocable and irrevocable trusts, another piece to that is a funeral plan. And I don't know if you're going to get into that or not.
I'm not actually going to talk about that. We do have an entire process for memorializing documents. We have kind of like a 10-page worksheet that asks you to think about everything from green burial or what you want to happen to, you know, actual service planning to all the things. But I'm not going to talk about it today.
Well, and just a quick thing. If you do have a disabled child and you do want to do funeral planning for that individual, make sure you choose an irrevocable funeral plan. Because if they are on medical assistance and you have a revocable plan, they're going to make you change it. And that could cost more money.
There's a value to that, right?
Right. And if there's a value to a revocable funeral plan, it could push them off of medical assistance. So that's just...
And that goes into what kind of trust planning and things that we do. The only way to leave assets and money to a loved one that is dependent on services, aid, Social Security, disability, government benefits, receiving that inheritance will most likely disqualify, invalidate their benefits because now they have money they can spend instead of getting that from the state or government. Okay, and just to see who's in that generation, say you're over 40 without saying you're over 40, the more you know. Anyone? Nobody remembers that?
Sure.
Come on. Okay. So when we're talking about planning outside of wills and trusts, the main things we do for incapacity planning are both healthcare and financial planning. So that is anything up until the point of death. So with incapacity planning in healthcare specifically, there are variations of how lawyers and online services create documents. We create three separate documents to make sure we're meeting all of the different aspects of healthcare needs. So your healthcare directives is your healthcare power of attorney. And then your end-of-life decisions, or what people hear of as living will, not the same as your will. That is a last will and testament. A living will specifically is healthcare-related. That is where we document end-of-life and treatment decisions, and then a HIPAA authorization. I am sure dealing with loved ones that you are caring and responsible for, you are up to your eyeballs in HIPAA forms. But we do one across the board that says everyone we've listed and anyone else we would like to get information, here's the people that can have that. So more specifically, healthcare directives, those are your medical durable power of attorney, and what they do is name your healthcare agents and give them the permissions they need to manage long-term care and hospice care, to keep you in your home as long as possible if that is your desire, anatomical gifts and autopsies. Anatomical gifts are your organ donations, research, anything that you are willing to allow to use your body for, and you can say yes or no to that in any level of capacity. You can say, I'm only okay with organ donation for life-saving purposes, or I'm okay with research or things like that. There is so much, as I'm sure there's so much other resource and discussion just today on all the resources for things like Alzheimer's studies and all of that. So when you're talking with loved ones and doing this planning or assisting them with planning, really getting an idea of what they are willing to do or what they might want to be a part of to help with that ongoing research.
And yeah. I would say that the court system, prior to appointing a guardian or conservator, which is a little more restrictive to the individual, we love to see healthcare directives. We love to see power of attorneys because those are less restrictive. You're using your support system that you have around you. You have a trusted person that is helping you, and you only want to jump to guardianship when these roles are not providing enough safety or support for the individual that you're appointed to serve.
Yep. So in your healthcare power of attorney, you can name two separate agents or actors. You can name your healthcare agent, who is the person who's going to sign off on medical treatment, surgeries, look at your medical records, help pay bills, and work with if you have a different financial person. Your physical healthcare guardian is different, can be different from your agent. If you, that is the person that is going to, that you are now the dependent. They are your adult parent role type person that is responsible for your actual physical care and well-being. If you can't live at home with them and they can care for you, they can outsource that, or it may mean just coordinating care for things like long-term care facilities, nursing care, assisted living, or even if it's something like therapy, like rehab, where you're only in there for a period of time, your healthcare guardian would be the person that would coordinate those things, as you said, right? If if the general agent is not enough. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's really important to know is they're executing your wishes with guidance. This is not a DNR. You sign a DNR, you go into the hospital, or something happens, you're in an accident. If you say, do not resuscitate, I don't want, you know, to be on life support, I don't want CPR, you are not getting it. In this scenario, it is the agent that is using these documents to get the guidance of what you want when you were able to say what that is to execute that plan, but they have a lot of room for judgment. So if it's something like you say, I don't want to be kept on life support if I'm in a permanent coma and two doctors agree I'm never coming out of it, we're starting to have conversations about donating organs, things like that, that doesn't mean you come off life support that day. It means that it takes time for family to get there, or maybe we want to try one more thing for another week. The agent has authority like that separate from a DNR. So it is not binding in the same way. They are asked legally to honor your wishes, but they have the final say.
And then going back one screen, I didn't get a photo of that.
And I can send this to you. I can't go, but I mean, I guess I can. Do you mean the screen before this entirely?
Yeah, with the documents.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but feel free to email me. I will send it to you. Okay. Let's go through. Did you have anything else, Rebecca, you wanted to add there? Okay. All right. So, FYI, if you are married, it is not automatic that your spouse is the one who gets access to your medical records or the final say in your care. If anyone remembers the Terry Schiavo case from the 80s, there was a conflict between her spouse and her parents who did not agree about life support. And that lasted for a very long time, way longer than it should have. The main reason, and this applies to financial too, there is no medical facility or organization that is going to assume your spouse is the one that has your best interest at heart or who you want making those decisions. If that were the case, we would not have shows like Dateline and 2020, right? All right. Do you want to go into the guardian?
Yes. All right. So as I said earlier, my role is serving as a guardian and conservator, and I just want to talk a little bit about what I can do as a guardian and conservator. We'll start with the guardianship piece, and I just want to make clear that once somebody is appointed a guardian, that doesn't take the individual's rights away. That person is still an individual. They can still make choices. They can still make bad choices. We are there as a court-appointed decision maker to assist. Our clients still have the right to refuse treatment. And, you know, we are there to do, basically, we will only be appointed the roles. These are different roles that the court thinks we need, right? But they're not going to appoint all 10 things if the person is able to manage in certain areas. For example, managing their personal property. We don't need to take care of that if they're capable, all right? The court might appoint
us. I'm going to go forward, but I can go back too, because there's 10 of these, right?
So go back to the first one for just a second. We'll just kind of run through them real quick. The first one, the power to have custody of the person subject to guardianship. And that basically means that we're going to assist them in finding a place to live if that's needed, helping them to maintain the place they live, and also help to make sure the services where they live are sufficient and that they're safe in the place that they're living. If not, we'll step in and we'll make some choices with them and or for them if they are not able to make that choice themselves. The second one is to help provide for their care, comfort, and maintenance needs. That means that we are going to help them with maybe education, maybe vocational training, and finding the supports for that individual. So one of my goals as a guardian is I like to create a team around me. So I am the ultimate decision maker in some respects, but I also have a team of social workers or care managers or vocational coaches, and I line up all of that with the resources that I have at my disposal. And a lot of those resources are on the back of that purple card. The third one here is, we already talked about it, to take care of an individual's personal property. Just some stories that I can quickly share is sometimes we store things for people in a storage unit because they can't have everything with them wherever they live. If they need money for shopping or if they need assistance with shopping, we will help them with that as well. Maybe they have a vehicle that we need to help figure out where is that vehicle going to be. Is it stored? Is it insured? And the person insured? So we have to make sure, is the person able to drive? Should the person be driving? If you come across somebody who should not be driving anymore, and that comes up a lot, don't be the bad guy. You don't have to be. You don't have to be a guardian either. This could apply for anybody. Let your doctor be the bad guy. Let the doctor, the next time you're in there, call ahead of time and explain to the doctor what's going on. Mom or dad's getting lost. They're driving over curbs. They're hitting their own garage door, or they're just a danger, and explain why. And then that doctor can assist you. That way you can maintain that relationship with the individual that you are trying to protect. So number four is important because guardians do give permission for certain medical care to happen. I've had to authorize an amputation before. I've had to authorize emergency surgery. I have to authorize, it could just be medical appointments or prescriptions. But there's a few things we cannot do. We cannot authorize psychosurgery.
You have to authorize that in your healthcare directive specifically, that someone can give you psychological treatment, including things like electroshock therapy, which is coming back around, yep. Antipsychotics, institutionalize you. That's not part of general medical authorization.
Correct. We cannot authorize sterilization. So, for example, if you have a client who, say, has maybe Down syndrome, right, and that person still has the right to get married, we've had that happen, and that's just fine. Sometimes it's a full marriage, you know, where they have a special buddy where they are super close to. We've had that happen. That's just fine. It's not a legal
My cousin
marriage.
Is married. They live independently in a, right. like, home for other, you know, with all adults with Downs, severe autism, things like that. Thank you.
Right. And so, yep. And so if, you know, I can't authorize sterilization, that would be cruel and that requires a court order. So does the other two things we just finished talking about. I cannot also authorize any type of experimental treatment. These things require a court order. The court oversees everything a guardian does, as well as a conservator, and we have to answer to the court for any decision that we make. So it's super important to know that.
Rebecca, I'm just going to cut you off because we only have 15 minutes left and we want to do Q&A. Are there any, like, very key ones on the – we can send
well,
out the list.
We'll skip to the next one real quick okay. here. My ultimate role is to provide supervisory authority over the individual. I can't restrict them to seeing people or talking with people. I can't restrict their mail. So individuals that are under guardianship still have a lot of autonomy. I just want to get that point across. And we can skip to the next slides and we can email them to you. And go to the next one. Conservatorship, That's really small to read. We can email that out. But conservatorship is over financial matters, okay? That is where we are appointed. We need to understand what their assets are. Is there a house? Are there stocks? Are there investments? Are there bank accounts all over the place? One example, and then I will pass the baton back to Sarah. We have a recent client that needed a conservator, an emergency conservator. Husband is elderly. She was found in a uninhabitable home and in awful conditions. And it turns out that this couple has $20 million of Apple stock, and they've got a few thousand dollars at this bank and that bank, and it was all over the place. And this just went on and on and is still going on. They have cars that need to be dealt with. They have property out of state that needs to be dealt with. So conservatorship is about financial matters. We're also able to help individuals with drafting, I should say. You know, we'll work with them on a healthcare directive so we understand what their wishes are if they're able to express that to us.
Good. Okay, so let's go back just to living will and the other documents really quick. With the living will being your end-of-life decisions, those are specifically the treatment decisions. The categories are if you're in a permanent coma, if you're in hospice at the end of life, what are the decisions around that? And then in Minnesota, my favorite place to be, we have a third one, which is if saving your life would return you to a quality of life that you don't want, you want to be let go or let that naturally occur. Those are things like oral feeding and fluids. We have a lot of, obviously, Alzheimer's, dementia, memory care that will start to refuse and I'm not taking that or things like that. What are their wishes? The earlier, obviously, we can plan and document those things. If they say, okay, if I get to a point where I'm being really stubborn and I don't want to eat, is it likely because I just don't want to do this anymore? And that's okay, that's their right. Or, you know, is it, no, it's probably because I don't know what's going on or I feel like I would still want you to try to you know, get a line and things like that, right?
And it's important to look at the person at that place where they are in life and consider what might be in their living will or consider your experience with that individual and understanding what their wishes might be.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to necessarily extend life if it's going to be painful for the individual.
Mm-hmm.
You know, instituting hospice care is really a blessing for individuals, and yeah. There are a lot of great hospice companies out there. You know, you want people to be comfortable.
And we have amazing, like, death doulas that are here today and things like that. Their work is just so incredibly beneficial. And one of the things we also document is pain management, is specifically the language essentially says, we understand if you administer pain management when we're already at end of life, things like organs shutting down, those are usually opiates, morphine, things like that, that is going to hasten the process. And so we want someone to be able to sign off and say, I'd rather have pain management and shorten this process than not have it, and withholding certain interventions if they're at certain stages or experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then the HIPAA release, if anyone doesn't know what that is, that's the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. Yeah. And that gives healthcare providers permission to give your health records and information to others, including your guardians and conservators. So you also get to choose who gets that and also what level of information they get. So you'll see you've got obviously your healthcare agents need all the information to make educated decisions. Your loved ones may need less. They want to be able to call the hospital or facility and check on you and not get the answer. You're not on the authorized list to get that information. And you'll see that me as your lawyer is on there because we need to know if an incapacity has occurred and that we can then assist. And this is where that personal family lawyer experience or someone like that comes in versus a transactional lawyer. We're still in your back pocket on call, and if we get a call on Saturday at midnight that that's happening and we need assistance with the facility and we really just want you to tell them what everything is happening, we can facilitate that as well, and that can be part of general planning that nobody's trying to figure out who's going to pay for that or who we're calling. And so it lets you choose and what they get. Going back to the financial, there's two main documents that we use, the general durable power of attorney that you'll usually hear referred to just as your POA, and asset tracking is something specific to the more extensive process. So when we're in capacity planning, general durable power of attorney gives your power of attorney, your financial agent, it says who they are and gives them permission to manage all the things that Rebecca was talking about, bank accounts, investments, your trust, pay your bills and medical expenses, and even handle things like taxes. Again, back to that same conversation, nobody automatically gets authority to touch your stuff, even your spouse, if you're the only one with a name on it, because we're back to that same situation, right? When we talk about asset tracking, I could go on and on about this. This is knowing where things are and what they are. In Minnesota specifically, we have around $834.6 million in the Department of Unclaimed Property. That is all somebody's stuff they didn't know to ask for, inherit, or claim.
One of the first things I do when we're appointed to a conservatorship is we contact unclaimed money or missing money Minnesota. And that is one way where you can track assets for an individual. You should check it for
everyone
yourself.
Go home and put your name in.
Absolutely.
You can Google it.
I did it. I found that I was due some money back from the state for different things, and it's enough money probably to take you
my
to
husband
dinner.
At 42 my husband at 42 found out he had a $5,000 CD from his bar mitzvah.
Yep.
Didn't know it.
Yep.
Federally it's 70 billion with a B. 70 billion, and that's all people's stuff. Okay. So the other thing with asset tracking, not only knowing that you have stuff to claim, but how many people have a partner or spouse or someone that is the family CFO or CEO and manages the money, the assets, investments, paying bills, all of that. If you aren't that person, or you are that person and you're worried about the other one that isn't, how are they going to know what to do in an emergency? We create asset tracking that not only tracks what happens to it through the estate, but also what happens to it during life and how to do things like log in and pay bills. Also, when you set up your estate plan, a trustee can step in at any point, incapacity, death, anything in between, and they need to be able to step in, know when the mortgage is due, is it on auto pay, is it a check, what's happening, and how to do that. And also, when we, again, going back to estate planning, we have to move money around and assign it in a way that it will flow through the system as easily as possible and not hopefully through the court. Your chosen agents have immediate access to all financials and know where everything is when they know how to access the asset tracker that tracks literally everything. So nothing gets, yay. All right, so I know we're running really low on time. I know the biggest question people have outside of healthcare and who can make decisions is, what's a will, what's a trust, what do I need? Obviously, I can't go into all the details, so I just want to give you kind of some key points. The biggest differences are when they take effect. A will takes effect only when you die, and any asset that is only in your name is immediately frozen as soon as the banking institution knows that there is a death. Trusts, however, take effect immediately as soon as they're signed and assets are immediately available. When we are in will planning, that is going through the probate court first, and you've got usually on average with wills only about a 3 to 6 month wait before anyone can access those assets. So somebody's got to pay your mortgage during that time. Someone's got to pay your funeral expenses. And then eventually they can get reimbursed. That can be super burdensome on a lot of families. The property wills only cover the stuff that's in your own name alone. Trusts cover everything that is jointly funded or transferred that you decide to be in that plan that will then immediately pass to someone or be accessible for use. They are administered. The will plan is public. It is through the court process. It's probate. Probate is a litigation. It is a lawsuit of your estate against itself, which sounds completely bonkers, and it's the only time we do that. It is to let everyone in the world know that someone has passed, and if you are a creditor or feel you are owed money from that person, you get that before the heirs get anything. It is not a process to make sure your heirs get their inheritance. It is not. Trusts are private. They don't require any legal action unless somebody chooses to fight about things. However, if they are drafted properly, there are automatic exclusions that say you want to fight or say this isn't what they chose or what they would have done, you're automatically disinherited. That is allowed in Minnesota and most states nationally. And then the time and effort, like I said, there's an initial waiting period in probate, but generally a probate where no one is fighting about anything is an average of 3 years here to close. close out. So when you say, I'm choosing to have a will, and I am naming my executor, the person that is going to execute that plan and go through the legal system, what you are doing is going to them and saying, I've just volunteered you for a lawsuit litigation that's going to last about 3 years. Like, thank you so much. With trust planning, it's immediate. We aren't going through the court system. I put kind of a placeholder of if your asset tracking is up to date, it should be $0 to administer an estate plan, or maybe somewhere in the $250 to $500 if you're outsourcing taxes or certain things. Anything you want to add there?
Well, I just want to say this piece is really important, and you can do this, and you can do power of attorney, and you can
we
do healthcare.
Everything.
It's a whole package.
Yeah.
Because power of attorney ends upon death, so you want to have a
correct
backup plan.
And so we call this, like, think of it as a pie. Every single one of those documents, healthcare mm-hmm. directive, power of attorney, will, trust, they're all one wedge of the pie. None of them work completely on their own, okay? So the last thing I'll say, and then I'll just skip to the end, is that I refer to a trust as your little red wagon. It is your radio flyer wagon, and if you think about that in the sense that the way, what it means to have a trust and fund it is instead of just creating a document, it is a document, but you are purchasing a wagon or a container. It starts empty. Funding your trust is getting all your things in there. The rule is that every single thing that is in your wagon at death bypasses court and doesn't have that cost of about 2% surcharge to get it through the system. They're flexible. You can change careers. You can move states. You can, you know, change assets, take things in and out of your wagon. You have full control of that during your lifetime. So it holds all your things. We know why legacy matters, right? It's to make your wishes known and have those things documented. Just a summary of all the key actors we were just talking about, and I want to end with a trivia, which is, okay, how much did the IRS receive from Prince's estate? Anyone know? Yeah, might as well have been. It was about $120 million. And obviously all of us in Minnesota know
right.
what kind of philanthropist he was, what he did for the schools and all of his charities. He was estranged from most of his family, and they ended up with all of the money instead of all of those, you know, charities and things that he would have wanted. He didn't even have a will. All right. So anybody want to take a screenshot of that? Obviously do. There's one for Rebecca as well, or as we've said, we'll be happy to send it to you.
Mm-hmm. I just want to make sure we get to
yes.
answer a couple questions.
I'm happy to stay longer, although I don't want to keep anyone from lunch, resource fair. I will be at the table, as will Rebecca. We will answer as many questions as we can. She's going to give you the box.
If you have a question. And don't forget to fill out your evaluation now that you've attended the keynote and the first breakout. There will be prizes for a drawing at the end if you turn your evaluation in before you leave today. And you can win something in a drawing, too. So we appreciate it. It's the way we can only learn and grow
absolutely.
From these experiences by having evaluations filled out. So we really
I'll
do
email it to you.
Read
mm-hmm.
them and value
just reach
them.
Out to me or give me your worksheet when you're done.
Yeah,
feel okay. free to make all the notes, questions you want for both of us on the pink worksheet, and we will absolutely make sure. Yeah, go ahead with your question.
So the question is, if you're in the process of changing your will or possibly moving it into a trust, and you have medical issues, what makes the living will and the other medical
mm-hmm.
form legal?
By signing them. They have to be signed in a certain way. They have to be witnessed, notarized, and as soon as that is done, they are effective. They don't have to be filed anywhere here. So we guide you through how to store the original documents, who to notify, and how to make those choices, but they're immediately effective. Anything
okay.
you want to add to that? Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Sorry.
Well, one of the things you sometimes deal with in estate planning are Medicare, Social Security, medical assistance. And with all the craziness going on in Washington now, who knows whether there's going to be any of that in 10 years or 5 years or two
mm-hmm.
years. What do you have? Is there anything you can do to deal with that?
Well,
great question.
I can't speak to specifics about what's going on in Washington. I suggest just trying to stay as informed as you can. But remember, the federal government still funds the states. So there's still going to be programs available. That's my understanding. I, too, have worried about that because I'd like to retire tomorrow, but I don't think that's going to happen. But I wouldn't necessarily worry about that. I think certain people like to rile up other people, and it just creates more of an emotional havoc. So I won't worry about it right now. There's always going to be state funding to help provide for individuals who need the help.
And just
and
be
we
prepared.
Keep an eye on all those things.
Yeah, and have these documents in place. That's your best way mm-hmm. to
It's really the only thing we can do. You know, mm-hmm. the law is a moving target, which is why updating things is so important, too. If things change, we go with those,
she
you know.
She had a question here
yeah.
real quick. Go ahead.
So if somebody has Alzheimer's and you they have like a generic health care directive that doesn't yet indicate DNR, DNI, psychotherapy, like medications, that kind of thing, do you need something more specific? Can the Pulse cover that, or do you need to redo the health care directive?
A Pulse is a great tool to have. It's signed by a doctor. It also expresses what your wishes are, whether you want to have or be resuscitated if your heart were to stop or if you were to stop breathing. It talks a little bit about what type of status. Do you want to have full interventions or no interventions? Do you want to do some trials? You know, there's some areas on that form that will allow you to make some of those decisions a little more clear.
The general leak,
it's a PULSE form. It stands for Provider Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment, I believe.
The legal answer, though, I will tell you, is if there are no specifics listed, but an agent is listed, and that is the most current document, that agent has broad authority to make the decisions. The idea with that, going back to the healthcare directive, is guidance. So if the guidance isn't there, the agent's going to make those decisions on their own or reach out to trusted advisors that can advise in making those decisions. But if those specifics haven't been documented, it's the agent's job to decide.
We have two more questions we're going to get before we have to wrap up. Go ahead.
Okay. I could be a poster child for what you led with, which was we know what everybody's done wrong. So we're here. Okay.
I don't mean to laugh, but it's so
and
common.
And it's so true because I'm a CPA. I worked at a nationally recognized trust company early in my career and still felt confident enough in my two siblings that I could sign a power of attorney so that we were, you know, all three power of attorney. Mm. Okay. On it, we did a statutory short form. Because I thought I knew what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now
those are very, very little use to those anymore.
Okay. Anyway,
if anyone has questions about that, let me know.
Those were working fine. My mom has been in the Alzheimer's journey for 5 years now. My siblings both want her to stay in her home, but do not want to help.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm doing most. I'm managing
Check.
Pretty much
yep.
everything,
mm-hmm.
and. Have said since the doctor said she needs to go into a nursing home 3 years ago, have said that's what I think is best. But they don't agree, and so we're all power of attorney, and they won't agree.
So is the question, what do we do when we have three and
yes,
no one can
and
agree?
One thing you were saying, Rebecca, in your presentation was that the guardian has power to establish abode, but do they have power to change the person's abode if they don't want to leave their home and your siblings, who are also power of attorney equally with you, don't want her to leave her home? That's
yes.
my question.
A guardian can make that decision.
Okay.
Okay, thank one you. Last question. Sorry. And then we have to get to lunch. Y'all are probably hungry.
How do you go about establishing a living trust? Where do you go? What do you do?
You go to an estate planning attorney. Yeah. So you would contact an attorney, say that's what I want to learn about and do, and then the key thing, and if anybody wants to go, like, my website and stuff is on there. I have a bunch of free downloads of, like, how to choose an attorney, what questions to ask, what you need to be thinking about when you're doing planning specifically. But you should work with an estate planning attorney to do that for you and then make sure that they're going to guide you not only by creating and signing those documents, but how to actually fund that wagon and do all the things that go along with that.
Thank you,
and
Sarah.
And I'm happy to answer more questions.
Thank you, Rebecca. I'm sorry we have to go. But
thank you all so, so much.
I'll collect some pink forms.
They'll be at the resource fair,
too. Yes, our tables are at the resource fair, too, so please come ask more
questions. So head on down to lunch and enjoy your lunch.
Thank you. Thank you.